listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly discussion with Joe Loria, the editor-in-chief of ConsortiumNews.com, about the headlines at ConsortiumNews.com, and we're going to start today with a story that says essentially the dead in Yemen, much larger count than everybody thinks, and everybody's saying how horrible it is. Let's talk about that first, Joe.
Well, thanks, Don. I'm really happy to be here in studio with you for the first time up from Washington. Yes, the Yemen story now has become finally a hot story for the corporate media. As everyone knows, they've been more or less ignoring that, except from the very beginning of the war. And why? Because the U.S. has played, and the U.K. have played a major role in logistical support, refueling of planes, choosing bombing targets. They've had a big hand in that. I've always felt that this war began in the Obama administration, by the way, and now suddenly we're getting Democrats saying this war has to end. Mm. And we had Samantha Power, for example, tweeting that this is Trump's war somehow. It was under her own administration,
right,
blaming Trump for this. Right. Now, I do blame Trump for continuing it.
Right.
But the idea of letting Obama off the hook is just absurd, but typical in the hyper-partisan environment we're
with Trump, by the way. You know, when he backs off in Syria, for example, they yell at him. He's being Putin's puppet and everything. And so if he were to lean out of Yemen, you know, pull the U.S. out of there right now, he'd be hearing grief from those same people.
Possibly, but things have changed because of the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, of course.
Yeah,
that changed everything. One of their own, as they assume, because he wrote a column for the Washington Post, one of their own was killed. Now, he really wasn't a journalist, as Assad Abdul Khalil wrote in one of our stories a couple of weeks ago, a very fine profile of Khashoggi, and told us a lot of things, that he worked with Osama bin Laden closely in Afghanistan, for example. The guy is a defector, and that's why he was probably killed.
Yeah.
And there is no journalism in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. But anyway, he's seen as a as one of them. So therefore, this scandal has, you know, of course, it's horrible that he was killed. But the idea that this now is bleeding over into the Yemen war. So there's been a bill in Congress for a while to get the U.S. to stop helping. But it's starting to go somewhere now, and the voices are raising. So now it's time to look at how many people have actually been killed with American help in Yemen since the war began 5 years ago, or 4 years ago. And that figure has always been hovering around, you know, within 5,000 to 10,000 for all this time by the World Health Organization.
Right.
But our article now points to an NGO that admitted their mistake and went back and upped their estimates of the number of people killing Yemen to between 70,000 and 80,000 when they had just a couple of months earlier said that it was around 10,000, which was the World Health Organization figure.
At UNICEF, meanwhile, in December 2016, said that a child was dying every 10 minutes in Yemen. Everything's worse now than it was then. That's 2 years this coming month. So that's 24 months. You know, one every 10 minutes is 144 a day, or 14, 28, 4,200, 4,300 a month, or almost 50,000 a year.
That's
times
right.
2 years.
That's right.
So that's just 100,000.
That's
using
right.
UNICEF
I actually
numbers.
Did the arithmetic as I was editing the story, and it was 104,000.
Okay.
So I just said in the piece more than 100,000 because that's an estimate.
So I did pretty good in my head.
Not bad. Here on this, right here, while we're recording this interview, that's pretty good. I did it. I took my time in advance to do that. So that's a shocking figure, obviously.
Yeah.
That includes deaths, however, from diseases. Diphtheria and cholera have been a big cholera epidemic that's broken up because of the war. So it is a war death. It's not necessarily from a bomb, but it's from a disease that would not have existed except for this war. So 100,000 people more have been killed from all causes due to this war. And it's shocking and horrible. And this number has to get out there to increase the anger there should be in the public and in Congress in particular to end this bloody conflict because it's an outrage what's gone on. It's really been an unbelievably criminal war that's been ignored in the West. And supported in the Gulf media, Gulf Arab media, of course. They're part of the coalition.
Yeah. Yeah, it factors into domestic politics in Saudi Arabia, too. If you can call that, I don't know what, that mania that goes on there, domestic politics. You know, Salman and just locally, the new guy's project, this is one of two. The other one, well, you had the Bahrain occupation. And then you have this war against Yemen. Oh, and of course, and Syria.
Well, Syrian war and the Bahrain invasion. Well, they asked them in, so they their intervention into Bahrain happened before Mohammed bin Salman, the son of the king, had any kind of portfolios in government.
Right.
But he was the defense minister, and he had a couple other portfolios. But he was a defense minister when this Yemen war was launched. So this is his war, and it's gone badly. And, you know, in a normal country, even with our very defective democracy we have in the United States, there are times when the public and people in Congress can get fed up and there could be a change. That is not going to happen in Saudi Arabia. As long as he wants, nobody could step, could open their mouths and say a word in Saudi Arabia that this war is horrible, we're killing these people for nothing, we're wasting money because the economy, even in Saudi Arabia, as rich as they are, there's a huge population there of 80 million or so, and they're not all rich in Saudi Arabia like there could be in Qatar, where there's only 250,000 citizens. So the money they've got there, they can pay everybody off. So that thing, you know, this becomes an issue in Saudi Arabia, the cost of the war and the fact they're not winning. He's losing this war. He could not defeat Yemen, the poorest country in the region, and being attacked by the richest country in the region, and they can't win. So in any system where there was some kind of level of accountability for leaders, this war would have really nailed Salman, Mohammed bin Salman, and who's now, of course, become the crown prince in line to become the king. But it hasn't at home, and it didn't in the West until the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the guy who was writing op-eds for the Washington Post. That has upset the corporate elite media because one of their own was killed. Now it's a big deal. And of course, his murder was horrible, but it's not horrible compared to the 100,000 people we've just been talking about that were killed in Yemen. It's nothing compared to that. But now in the U.S., we're seeing in Congress and in the media, the New York Times did this huge piece in the magazine section 2 weeks ago about this war in Yemen. So now they've discovered it all of a sudden because of the murder of Khashoggi. So at least something, you know, there's a reason for the attention now. But still, we have to look, as we do in this piece, at the numbers of killed. That has not seeped out because they're still quoting these U.N. figures, which are abominably low.
And outdated.
And outdated, yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's 2 years out of date.
So we were happy to have this piece from Nicholas Davies. We wrote it.
Yeah, to give us a little background on Nicholas.
Well, Nicholas has written a book about the war deaths in Iraq, and he mentions that in his piece. And then he did a three-part series for Consorting News earlier this year, and he looked at war deaths from U.S. wars since the last few years. So this is a air specialty for him. And he looks beyond the numbers and looks at the methodology behind counting war deaths. And unfortunately, there was a quote, I think it was Tommy Franks, the general during the Afghan conflict, where he was quoted as, or in Libya, I can't remember which war, there's so many of them.
Yeah.
But he said, we don't count the dead of the civilians on the other side.
Right.
You don't count them. Now, maybe they do and it's secret. I don't know, but they don't make a deal. They don't want any attention paid to this. That's horrific, if you ask me. Yeah. That is just such sociopathic, Don, really.
Yeah.
That we go there and kill these people, we don't count them and don't want anybody to count them. And remember, the New York Times, to their credit, did a real study about how many people were killed in Libya.
Right.
And they came up with a very large figure.
Yeah.
And they ran that on the front page. And I was surprised that the Times did that, because that's what journalism is all about, to hold the government to account. They don't count the numbers. Well, we have to then as reporters. So,
you know, the population of Libya, if I recall, when I was there in October of 2009, was around 8 million, and at the end of the U.S. war on Libya in October, I guess formally October 20th of 2011, population was 6 million. Now, there was a mass exodus of people, you know, across the Mediterranean and across Africa, so we don't know how many people died and how many people ran for their lives, but that's an awful lot of dislocation. That's a quarter of the population.
Sure, it's on the scale of almost of Syria, which was worse, though.
Yeah. I mean, that would be like 75 to 80 million people in the United States.
Yeah, just disappearing somehow.
Yeah. Well, I remember reporting back pretty close to the beginning of the war on Yemen, like in May or June of, what was it, 2015, 2016? I don't even remember that. 2015, I think. That there were at that time something like 9 million people, or almost half the population, better than a third of the population, were food desperate. Like they were days from starving. And I remember more than a year ago now, journalist Caleb Maupin from RT was part of a convoy, the ships, some boats, a flotilla, trying to bring supplies into Yemen. And they were, but you know, basically run off by the Saudi Air Force. They threatened to, and they, I think they even, you know, dropped bombs in the water or something to scare them off, so they couldn't bring food to these people. I can't imagine that they've been having pizzas delivered or anything, and so one wonders how exactly the numbers are even in six figures and not seven or eight at this point.
I remember being told by a UN spokesman when I was still based at the UN, where I was for 25 years, that they were about to declare this the World Food Program, or the WHO was about to declare this a famine. And that has never officially been done. And as Don and I were talking about before we recording, it was for political reasons. The Americans clearly have put pressure on the UN, as they always do, and the Saudis put pressure on them. But I did a piece the very beginning of this war. And I reported that Ban Ki-moon was furious, because I got very good sources that told me that the way the Saudis were treating him and the UN in terms of the humanitarian crisis they were creating in Saudi Arabia, they just didn't care. And so the UN was muzzled, and Ban Ki-moon had to be muzzled about that, and he actually became angry, which is interesting. I also did a story just after the war began, the outgoing UN envoy to Yemen, who was working on Jamal Ben Omar, told me before he was making his last Security Council briefing, before he left to be replaced by a Saudi guy that they liked. They didn't like Jamal. He told me that he believed the war began because he was very close to a deal to solve this thing. And the Houthi had agreed to withdraw from Sana'a. There was going to be UN-trained force take place. The Houthi would take 20% of the seats in parliament, etc. But the only problem was the presidency. Hadi, the guy who was chased out and was living in exile in Saudi Arabia, wanted full power to come back, and the Houthi and the other parties wanted him to be to share power somehow. And then suddenly Saudi started bombing. So I did this.
His term was up too, but the agreement that put him in office two years or three years yes. earlier, or whatever, his term was up like at the end of 2014, and I think all what we're talking about now was February and March of 2015.
Yeah, so this war is horrific. It has to end, and I think the number of deaths in the in Yemen needs to become big news. That's why we ran this story, because that could help move the people in Congress to put pressure on the administration to stop this, stop the Saudi. Now, there's been a story the other day, I don't know if it's true, Saudi Arabia asked the U.S. to stop refueling their planes. Right. They say they're able to do it now. I see a political move there, too. They're trying to take the heat off. They see what's going on because of Khashoggi. So they're going to say, okay, we don't need your help. So maybe they're secretly doing it, the U.S. continuing to refuel. But in any case, there's some movement in Yemen now, and it's interesting to see what's going to happen.
See, it's not just refueling because the U.S. needs the Saudis need the U.S. AWACS also for
Oh, yeah, exactly. That's why I think it's just a political PR move.
Right.
Because there's so much other help the U.S. is giving. The AWACS, I think they're choosing bombing targets. They're giving logistical support. They are doing everything except having American pilots fly those planes and drop the bombs, basically.
So we'll move from that to a story by Sam Husseini, who is usually part of the press corps at the State Department and elsewhere, somebody that you know and have seen out there in the world, talking about somebody that was dragged out of the Helsinki press conference with Presidents Trump and Putin because he had basically the essence of his question on the back of a pad, and that was a violation to not have signs or something, whatever. But they physically dragged him out. Nobody said a word about it. Jim Acosta gets decredentialed after pushing a woman's arm, away from her that was trying to take the mic back from him. And the whole press corps is defending Acosta against that dictator Trump.
Yeah.
What's up?
Well, Sam has written an interesting story here. Yes, I was watching, waiting like a lot of people to see this press conference begin between Putin and Trump, and suddenly this picture zooms in and I see Sam Husseini in a headlock. I said, I screamed at Sam.
Right.
So, it turns out Sam did do something unusual. I've been in hundreds, maybe thousands of press conferences over 30 years as a reporter. And obviously everybody wants to get called on, and they call on favorites, and especially in a press conference like this, there's so many reporters.
It was huge. It was like a gymnasium or something.
It was in a big hall.
Yeah, huge. Yeah.
A big hall. Yeah. They had these ceiling shots going down. I don't
you
know how
like
many.
A dot from the stage. So how if many you want to be seen, something to distinguish you, yeah.
So Sam scribbled what his question was going to be, which was nuclear ban treaty, not nuclear test ban treaty.
The INF.
Was a treaty that was passed at the General Assembly, gathering signatures now. Of course, the U.S. is not interested in signing it. I don't think Russia is right now either, but they are.
NPT, right. That's right. Right.
The nuclear ban treaty ban all nuclear weapons.
Yep.
Actually passed in the General Assembly. It's not coming into force yet. I don't think they got enough countries to sign on. But anyway, Sam wanted to ask them about that, Trump and Putin. Why don't you support this nuclear ban treaty, which would have been a totally legitimate and good question. And he wrote it on a piece of paper, nuclear ban treaty, that he was going to hold up. Now, of course, everyone saw that as he was about to hold a protest and that he wasn't a legitimate accredited journalist at that event, which he was. The Nation magazine and then Katrina van der Heuvel, the editor of The Nation, wrote on Twitter that he was indeed accredited because Acosta got there, says the guy says he's from The Nation. He was about to protest. So, and of course, within the press corps, the people at CNN or the New York Times, they're elitists. You're
Sam
not in their club.
He's an actual journalist, unlike Acosta. Acosta's a TV guy. He usually reads off a teleprompter or he showboats at a press conference.
Well, he's not in the same class.
Sam's a real journalist.
Sam asks questions that big corporate media reporters should be asking.
Right.
For example, he was suspended from the National Press Club a few years back because he actually confronted Prince Turki, who was the head of the Saudi intelligence, who came to Washington and did a press conference at the National Press Club. And in fact, why you do a press conference? You don't expect questions. Tough ones.
Right.
Sam asked one, and they suspended him for that. Tells you a lot about the National Press Club, that they would suspend one of their members for asking a tough, rude question of Turkey. Now, in Acosta's defense, to some extent, I think the question you had of Trump that day was legitimate, because I think it's ridiculous to call that an invasion. But he didn't form it in he didn't ask it in the form of a question. He was making statements,
right?
Like, this is not an invasion. That's not up to the reporter to say,
right,
that.
Right.
You say, well, how can you call this an invasion?
Exactly.
On what basis,
right,
is this,
right,
an invasion?
Right.
So your question is pregnant with a statement, but it's not a statement, right?
Right. And so, and wait, the way Trump, I mean, because he made a declaratory statement of fact or alleged fact. And Trump said, basically, let me run the country, you run CNN. I mean, that's kind of an appropriate response almost to the way Acosta presented this information.
And the other thing is, if it was against the kind of protocol that I've been involved in all of these high, and I worked at the UN 25 years, so I was at these big press conferences where heads of state and government were there. I never saw anybody hold up a sign like that. Right. Sam was not protesting.
Right.
But I also never saw anybody keep the mic that long at a press conference.
Yeah.
Yes, especially in a White House press conference. You had your questions. You got to sit down after
a
while.
And now the facilitator
that would normally
comes for the mic, and you,
yes,
push her arm out
yeah,
of the way.
Yeah, they're trying to say, you know, the anti-Trump forces are saying that was a doctored video that he didn't really hit her on. I'm not getting into that. I don't really know. But the issue was, you know, there are protocols about press conferences, and normally the other reporters would get if the guy hogs the mic.
Right.
Because, you know, and they didn't in that case, because they all hate Trump so much, and they saw this as, and I just want to make this, the best point Sam makes in this piece is that they're good for each other. CNN and Trump are helping each other to lock in each other's audiences.
Right.
That people gravitate to CNN, he says, because they hate Trump, and people root for Trump because they hate CNN. So they're like feeding off of,
right,
each other in this dance that is really horrific. And anybody who has a half a brain is disgusted by both of them.
Right, right. I mean, it's the same thing that you have between Fox and MSNBC, for example. You have this one is selling this opinion that is antithetical to the opinion this one is selling. They point at each other. They address each other.
And they get the ratings.
They have partisans behind them.
Yep.
I'm watching because I hate those people. I'm watching because I hate,
right,
those people. And by the way, there's a pretty much consensus on fundamental policy outside of the hot button issues like abortion or whatever. Imperialism is never discussed. Actual fundamental institutional racism is never discussed, only in ways that can't be resolved, you know, so that it fuels this thing. All of the systemic problems that face an imperial capitalist post-industrial world, there's consensus on those things to the extent that they're not even part of the landscape. It's like discussing water with fish in the water. So,
no, absolutely right. And during these midterms, we saw that. The war did not come up as an issue at all.
Right. Seven wars.
Yeah, none of them. And these are members of Congress and the Senate,
right,
and the House who could have a huge effect on war and peace. That's what they're supposed to, according to the Constitution,
right,
anyway. So it's horrific. That tribalism that you just described is getting the ratings. And that's what it's about, of course, for TV stations, for Fox and MSNBC. And that's the dynamic that Sam writes about here that I think is a quite interesting piece to read.
Yeah, and there's something else that he raises, too, by the way, which is something that we, you know, pretty near and dear to our hearts, because, and we've been working on. How about Julian Assange?
Right.
Hello. I mean, back in 2016, even all the way up to today, when they talk about the Russians hacking and this and that or whatever, what they're actually talking about is the evidence of corruption of Clinton and the DNC that was provided by WikiLeaks via, you know, by Julian Assange's construct. That made money for all of those guys throughout the whole election year in 2016 and 2018, for that matter. And his life is in danger, and they don't have not a peep about him as a journalist.
That's right. Sam writes, while corporate media obsesses about Trump's attacks on the press, it says nothing about the administration's possible prosecution of WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange or RT and Al Jazeera being forced to register as foreign agents.
Yeah. And Press TV, too, yeah.
And Press TV, so... yeah, I mean, the hypocrisy is all around in this story.
Heather Nauert also, she won't take questions now from RT's reporters or from Sputnik's reporters. At the press, she's the press, you know, face basically of the State Department, and yeah, they won't talk.
I know. It's horrific. It's wrong. Because they ask tough questions, that's why.
Yeah, right.
Not because they're the bad Russians.
Right. Right, because when they were the bad Russians, the bad Soviets, the bad communists, they used to answer their questions.
Interesting.
You know?
Point, Don. Very interesting. Yep. That's right.
So, and then we've got one more story, which is, this is my fave, actually, from John Kiriakou, himself one of those 17 intel agencies whistleblower, suggesting that Brennan and Clapper should not escape prosecution. Let me go into that a little bit.
Yeah, that he thinks they should go to jail, actually. And why?
Yep.
Because there was, during the midterms, when the focus of the media was on those elections, Chuck Grassley, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, he made an announcement. It was November 1st, and he said, which was overlooked by the media, that Brennan had ordered CIA hackers to intercept the emails of all potential or possible intelligence community whistleblowers who may have been trying to contact the Congressional Oversight Committees. That's the House and Senate Intelligence Committees.
Right.
Hacking the computers of the Senate, any Senate computer, is obviously illegal. An illegal use of a government computer,
right.
Illegal espionage and wire fraud. But Brennan and Clapper did notify Congress of this. And they this is what you're supposed to do. You know, the congressional notifications are the way the intelligence agencies inform the oversight committees of various matters. And in this case, they classified it, which is very unusual. To classify the notification, and therefore they hid behind this classification a crime, which is a crime itself, as John points out. It's a felony to classify a crime.
Right.
It's a felony also to classify something only for the purpose of preventing embarrassment to CIA.
Right.
I knew all this because I worked with Tom Drake on a book project once, and I learned a lot of this, and I know about the relationship between intelligence agencies and they actually ridicule, of course, the oversight committees, the intelligence agencies. They do everything to manipulate them.
Right.
And here's another example of that. Now, there's one thing I have to point out, though, that Grassley says that he could not have revealed this before because it was, I don't know why he's doing it now, but it was, he said he couldn't before because it was classified. So it was overclassified.
Right.
The fact is that on the amendment, I think the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution, anybody, any member of Congress in the middle of a legislative act is allowed to say anything he damn wants.
Right.
That's what Mike Gravel, Senator Mike Gravel, did when he read the Pentagon Papers into the record.
Right.
So these ideas saying I couldn't, I remember Dick Durbin saying, well, we knew that there was no WMD in Iraq, but we couldn't
right.
say anything because it was classified rubbish. He could have stood up there and said it and he could not have been questioned.
That's right.
There are languages you can't be questioned going to or from for anything you do while you're in the middle of it. So you can
yep.
declassify anything you want and not get in trouble. You cannot publish it in a book afterward or in a newspaper. That's illegal,
right.
But in the middle of a legislative
act. Right.
So this is a big story because it's, again, not gotten any attention. And for you listeners out there, this is what Consortium News is trying to do, bring you the stories that you're not getting in the corporate media. We publish 1, 2, 3 stories a day, but they are hopefully stories that either have not appeared or they have a completely different angle than you're getting from the corporate media. And this is a good example.
Serial violators, Brennan and Clapper.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, John Kiriakou wrote the piece. Of course, he's a whistleblower. He blew the whistle on torture on an ABC News interview. The guys who did the torture and the war crimes did not get prosecuted because Obama wanted to look forward and not backward. But who goes to jail? John Kiriakou.
Right.
For revealing. Same with Chelsea Manning. The war crimes that those videos that we saw reveal, none of those pilots or their commanders were even prosecuted, let alone gone to jail. Who goes to jail? Chelsea Manning for revealing it. This is a horrifying pattern that we see. This is a corrupt ruling class we have here that are protecting their interests to the point of jailing people who reveal their crimes, which is why they want to jail Julian Assange all together. But they're not going to stop WikiLeaks even if they did that. So that's just payback and sending a message if they can get Assange behind bars. And as we know, he's still in the embassy. So this is an important story, John Kiriakou's story, no question about
it. And then Clapper also. Clapper denies to Senator Wyden in an open hearing of the Senate Intel Committee, in other words, an oversight committee, that the NSA was spying on American citizens, and under oath, by the way.
Yep, public meeting. Right?
Yep. When he's challenged on that, this is the least dishonest response I could think of.
Can you imagine that?
How about, like, the truth?
Of course, he's never going to be prosecuted for
right
perjury, but he perjured himself. He admitted he perjured himself.
And by the way, why the reason he's perjuring himself is because he was asked if he committed a crime, which is what
basically,
that is.
That's right.
Illegally spying on American citizens.
That's right.
Multiple felonies. Each instance is a felony or multiple felonies, depending on the nature of the wiretaps, crossing state lines, yada, yada, yada.
Oh, just to answer my own question, the Grassley's got work to get him declassified, and he finally did. In the Trump administration, they declassified these notifications. So he spoke out. He issued the statement everybody ignored that John's writing about. But again, he could have he could have made this public before in the middle of a committee hearing or somewhere in a speech in the Senate. But, you know, the political consequences are extreme. Your colleagues, after Gravel did that, they wouldn't talk to him. He had no chance of being the head of a committee, a powerful committee anymore. So he was, like, on the outs with the other senators because he read the Pentagon Papers, which far more consequential document than even this. But Grassley got it declassified. So now we know about it. And John, who follows these matters, who knew Brennan very well, worked with him at the CIA, and doesn't like him, and doesn't think he was very bright and all this stuff. He's written a piece about that for us. Has provided our readers with this great story.
Yeah, John was one of the Obama eight, charged with five felonies, including three counts of espionage for blowing the whistle on the CIA's torture program. He says in the article, "Of course, I hadn't committed espionage. Those charges were eventually dropped." That's the kind of thing, though, they charge you with.
Of course.
And then let's sit down and see what you're going to plead to doesn't contain a death penalty, you know, or a life in prison.
Of course. And that's the same thing they did with Drake, and to his credit. You know, they gave him 35 years, espionage and all that. They wanted him to take a five-year deal.
Right.
He refused.
Yep.
Went right up to the day before the trial, and finally the government realized they had no case. They had to drop it.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know all the details of John's case, but John took the deal and they dropped the espionage. It's exactly right. It's used to get a deal.
Okay. Joe, thanks a lot. We'll speak with you again next week. Again, we've been talking about some of the stories at consortiumnews.com this week. The top three at the website. Yemeni war deaths have been underestimated by 5-1. Trump and big media clash or collusion. There's that C word again. And my personal fave, Brennan and Clapper should not escape prosecution. We were discussing all of that with Editor-in-Chief Joe Loria.
It's great to be here in studio with you, Don.
Our pleasure. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Has the media become unhinged in the era of Trump? The president's most ardent critics in the media hang on his every word. News cycle after news cycle are all about Trump, and much of this coverage is negative. Has journalism lost its purpose? Are journalists now nothing more than ideological advocates? Crosstalking the media, I'm joined by my guest, Charles Ortel in New York. He is a private investor and a writer, as well as host of the podcast show Sunday with Charles. Also in New York, we have Joe Concha. He is a media reporter for The Hill. And in Nashville, we cross to Roger L. Simon. He is an award-winning novelist and Academy Award-nominated screenwriter, as well as co-founder and CEO emeritus of PJ Media. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Joe, let me go to you first here. I guess I can pick the easiest example, the dueling match we saw with Jim Acosta and President Trump here. I mean, what is the state of journalism? I mean, I'm not letting either guy off the hook, at least at this point here. But what does that tell us about journalism today?
Journalism today, I would say, has become a matter of many more opinions being put into reporting, which is leading to mistrust by viewers and by audiences. And Jim Acosta is a good example of that. Jim openly debates the president on certain issues. He takes a side and then decides to become the captain of the debate team during press briefings like we saw last week. It eventually becomes a confrontation where after every press briefing, whether it be with White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders or with the president himself, the story becomes Jim Acosta and Donald Trump in terms of the confrontation, in terms of actual information that may benefit the American people as far as what the president is doing, his administration is doing. So last week is a perfect example. The president took 68 questions from 35 reporters. That's about an average of two per reporter. For whatever reason, Mr. Acosta felt he was entitled to ask four questions. And when asked to give up a microphone when the president wanted to move on, he held on to it like a three-year-old does a lollipop when you tell him that it's time to give up the candy. So I think that's the state of journalism today, where we have too many opinions being injected into actual reporting. And that's a problem, because you're supposed to report facts as a White House correspondent and not offer your feelings up on a particular topic.
Yeah, very well said. You know, Charles, you know, CNN says facts first. But I mean, CNN now is synonymous for a brand that says Trump is a liar. I mean, that's it. I mean, I can't understand how what few viewers they have left actually continue to watch it, because I don't care what Trump is doing every second of the day. Twitter is more than enough. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think the show, which is modestly amusing, Ancient Aliens, is getting more viewers than CNN. I mean, if you want to hear anti-Trump propaganda, you know where to go. If you want to tune into the White House press briefing, you'd like to see the many fine journalists, and there are fine journalists in the White House press corps, get a chance to ask questions and elicit facts. We're not interested in the news, in those reporters' opinions. We're interested in getting facts. And I thought journalism's, and I'm not a journalist, but I thought the goal of journalists was to report facts as news to a wide viewership. And I think increasingly more and more people are turned off to this approach, and that's why they're going to alternative formats. And that's why I think CNN and MSNBC and others like them are in serious jeopardy.
You know, Roger, one of the things that I look at, and we've mentioned CNN and MSNBC already on this program, what I find exhausting is their moralizing, because there's very little coverage on the opiate crisis, for example, in the United States, which is every year more people die related to this opiate crisis than the entire number of American servicemen that died in Vietnam. But I know you hear that sometimes, like with Tucker Carlson, and I think he's great at doing that. But you don't hear about these issues here. And it's because I think that the liberal media is moralizing. They think they're simply better than their political opponents. Certainly they think they're better than the president of the United States. Am I characterizing it fairly? Go ahead, Roger.
Oh, I think you are. But also there's another factor involved here, and that's the ever-popular money. I mean, what these people are trying to do is attract their audience. It's a very specific audience. Even though CNN is failing, MSNBC, which is almost a clone of CNN, is attracting a large audience. They've outwitted CNN at the same thing, because Acosta's kind of a moron. But basically, it's the same game. What's really interesting in the whole White House press corps is who gets to be there in the first place. One of the reasons things like the opioid crisis are not mentioned is the people who are sitting in that room are mostly the same people who've been sitting in the front rows since I first went there to write a screenplay. This is true. Back in the 80s, when I was given access to that room, it was the same ABC, CBS in the same front room. And essentially, it's a cartel. And the cartel dictates what is heard. It's the same as in a lot of countries, as in Russia, too. Only certain companies get a seat at the table.
Okay, Joe, let's now flip to the side of Donald Trump. Now, obviously, when you look at the Acosta-Trump collision course there, it's great for clickbait. It's great for everyone to have opinion upon it. I mean, again, it's very exhausting. But, you know, CNN and Trump, they feed off of each other. Instead of confrontation, it's advantageous for both of them, because there's a good number of viewers out there that just have complete contempt for Trump and, on the other hand, complete contempt for CNN. So it's almost like playing a game here. I mean, Trump really gets a thrill out of saying that about CNN and Acosta, because he knows his base loves it and it will be played over and over and over again. everywhere, including Fox. So, I mean, there is a very symbiotic relationship here. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, the oldest game in Washington is to attack unpopular institutions, right? A Republican used to attack the IRS. You're a Democrat, you would attack a Republican Congress, and so on. It's a mutually beneficial thing with the president and with CNN, for instance, or the media in general. But it's not just his base. In other words, 93% of Republicans feel that the media reports knowingly false information, which is a pretty scary thing. It's no longer biased now. It actually, some people see it as a completely intentional act. But then 79%, and this is an Axios poll, by the way, 79% of independents, 8 in 10 basically, say the same thing. A majority of Democrats say the same thing. So when the president attacks the media, there is no downside to that.
Yep.
In terms of him doing that. But to go back to an earlier point in terms of the same people being in the room, I have a proposal for this, and I'm actually borrowing this partly from Ari Fleischer, who used to be a White House press secretary under George W. Bush and Mike McCurry under President Clinton. And that is, we got to rotate different reporters in there. On one day, have the president White House press corps. Tuesday, bring in business reporters. Thursday or Wednesday, the foreign press. Thursday, maybe bloggers. And then Friday, everybody gets a three-day weekend, or bring back in the White House press corps. I think you get a lot more different questions in there and a lot more questions with substance instead of the sizzle that we're currently seeing.
Charles, that's a very good idea here. But the cartel, and I like how Roger phrases it, the cartel would have nothing to do with it. I mean, NPR and CNN and MSNBC, they will instantly complain. Yeah, well, you know, but again, it's a power struggle right now. I think Jim Acosta should have had his credentials suspended because he misbehaved himself. That's not his house. It is not his venue. But Charles, the liberal media believe it is their right to do exactly that. That is the problem.
Well, I think what we're seeing in the marketplace, and this isn't a modest plug for our show, is a move towards opinions that are backed up by sources. In every one of our broadcasts, we provide a slideshow for free with links to the primary sources so you can validate, you know, you can test for yourself whether our views and opinions make any sense, and you can do more work looking at it. There are a number of alternative sites that do that type of work, and I heard one statistic that, taken as a group, more and more people are getting their news from such sites via YouTube and other platforms than from the traditional media, because the traditional media is too slow, it's too inaccurate, as you point out, nobody trusts it, and they keep on falling on their face over and over again.
Oh, but then, Roger, I mean, okay, all three of you have suggested that what the liberal media is doing now is not working. But, Roger, why do they keep doing it then? I mean, the statistics are overwhelming, okay? I mean, just look at the ratings. I mean, the Cartoon Channel is doing well in comparison. Go ahead, Roger. Why don't they address this? Go ahead.
I don't think that's entirely true, unfortunately. I wish it were true, because if the Cartoon Channel were winning every time, I think the CNNs of the world would disappear. Unfortunately, I think that Trump has done them all a favor.
Yeah.
I mean, he's giving them all kinds of publicity. And I agree with Joe's proposal. I think it's a great one. And Sean Spicer, when he was the press secretary, was trying to do something sort of like that, but it seems to have gone by the wayside. But, other methods have to be taken, because in reality, like MSNBC is raking in the dough, which CNN isn't as much. But, you know, Fox is obviously making tremendous amounts of money. So it's not, the system isn't rigged yet for real news, unfortunately.
Okay, let me go to Joe before we go to the break here. Fox was mentioned here, and their business model is doing very well. Is it because they have, I'm thinking of like Hannity and Laura Ingraham. I mean, they obviously have a pro-Trump agenda. I mean, it's obvious for anyone to see. But it works. Joe.
Yeah, on the editorial side, they mostly have a pro-Trump agenda. There's plenty of never-Trumpers there, too.
Sure, sure.
I think Fox is somewhat unpredictable in that sense. Like, you don't quite know what Shep Smith or Chris Wallace or Brett Baer, the news side of the organization, they do a solid job. The other two channels, their news organizations have now become, or the news divisions have become opinionized. But the reason why Fox does so well, I wish I had a pie with me. I don't, so I'm going to have to draw a circle here. Okay. split that pie in half, Fox gets that 50%. CNN decided, let's go after the other half that MSNBC has in terms of liberal, and they get about 20% of that, and MSNBC gets 30%. And that's why they do well, because they have no competition from the right, and CNN decided to give up the middle. So that's basically it, and they just simply have more talent and more compelling personalities on there. It's that simple.
Hold that thought. We're going to go to a short break, gentlemen, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the media in the era of Trump.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Charles in New York. Much like what Joe does, I watch a lot of media. It gets more and more difficult as we go through this administration. You know, I'm more of an outsider looking in here, but it seems to me that the Democratic Party has MSNBC and CNN as their spokespeople. That's the way it looks from here, okay? And then I would even go further. I get the impression during this midterm cycle that a lot of Democrats watch CNN and MSNBC to get their talking points. It's almost a circular thing, okay? I've never seen such a large group of candidates repeat exactly the same thing, sometimes in order, okay? And I think there's a lot of viewers in the United States that have a big problem with that. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, I think it was Joe. I've heard him on television mention that one of the big conundrums right now is trying to figure out what is the true split between among Democrat, Republican, and Independent. I think Democrat-Republican share has fallen a lot and suddenly. So you're right. What we see here are Democrat talking points being spewed forth in a coordinated fashion, not just on CNN and MSNBC, but New York Times,
sure,
Wall Street Journal,
sure,
and other
sure,
places,
sure,
and most of the print and radio. So, I mean, instead of focusing right now, not on the Mueller investigation, but on the fact that it seems to me that Democrats are trying to rig not just the election, but the post-election gathering and counting of votes. That seems to be a serious fraud upon the American electorate. We're not spending enough time talking about that, but we have been obsessing for many months about whether Russia, you know, might have purchased some Facebook ads, you know, in a modest quantity that could have had an impact on the 2016 election. Integrity of elections strikes me as a very important issue across the entire political spectrum. We should care that we can know that our votes will be counted properly. And in this high-tech age, we don't have that assurance as it's being played out right before our eyes. That's a serious scandal.
I absolutely agree. You know, Roger, it seems to me another big problem here. You know, I'm a conservative. And all my viewers know that. Okay, so I'm going to criticize CNN and MSNBC probably far more than other television networks. But you know, it seems to me that the cultural war that is being played out. It seems to me that the liberal media is the flag bearer of that, about values, about families, what a family is, what about immigration, the whole transgender debate. I mean, if you look at conservative media and you look at CNN and MSNBC, you see two different cultural worlds there. And it seems to me that CNN really pushes that really hard. Is that a wise move on their part?
Wise move is a hard way to say it because it's what they believe. You know,
That's my point. They project their values. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all do. That's the sad truth. You know, one of the things that's being revealed that's positive about all this, if you pay attention, is this is what journalism always was. I mean, it's written by human beings, and all human beings are biased. Let's face it, I'm more on the conservative side as you are. And I think that there's a lot of silliness and absurdity in the values being projected by CNN. But I'm glad that it's all out in the open now. Because back in the old days, I mean, I'm not a young person anymore. I remember Walter Cronkite. And we all believed him religiously. But it turns out, back, you know, if you look back, some of the things he said were dead on wrong and probably purposefully. But in those days, there was no back and forth, really. It was, you know, it was totally dominated by three networks that essentially said the same thing. And now there's at least dialogue. That's an improvement in a certain way. I'd be interested to see what Joe said about that.
Yeah, well, you know, Joe, the interesting thing here is that, again, when I compare the cable stations, it's really, for me, the issue of omission. What is not discussed? For example, all of this, you know, during the summer with Russiagate, Peter Strzok, his girlfriend, Lisa Page, Bruce Orr and all that. I mean, looking at MSNBC and CNN, they just glossed over it because the president is attacking the intelligence community. On Fox, well, wow. I mean, if you wanted to get all of the details, they did a damn good job, and really a superb job. We'll see if that continues with the new Congress. But it's really, I see this as the media coverage of omission, of what is not talked about and what is crowded out because of how many scoops of ice cream Donald Trump had. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at one of the biggest stories that has been omitted since the president took office 2017, extending into this year, and that's that 98% of the territory controlled by the ISIS caliphate has been taken back, that caliphate has been eviscerated. You remember, ISIS dominated the news in 2015. It seemed every other week there was some sort of attack going on in Paris, in London, in New York, even more recently. Now you don't really hear much about them anymore. That's not to say they've gone away completely. There's going to be lone wolves, of course, but, I mean, that's a pretty big story. I mean, this ISIS was seen as the next Al-Qaeda, except much more reckless. You don't see any talk about that. And as you said, it's like two different galaxies sometimes when you watch Fox News and CNN and MSNBC, particularly with, and was brought up before, the Florida recount, where I could have predicted even before this happened, as far as the recounts, that CNN and MSNBC would take the side that there's absolutely nothing wrong going on in Broward County in Florida, and that Fox would be pursuing more the story in terms of, is there something going wrong? Who's responsible? And what's going to happen next? So, again, that's one network having a real news division and the other ones just becoming completely opinion and predictable opinion at that. Because you know why they do this? And I'll leave it here because I know you got to go. Fear from their audiences. They all check their Twitter feeds. Every anchor, I've been on many sets, every anchor, every host, when they go to commercial, they check to see what the reaction is. And if it's negative, they don't know how to handle it. So they want to give comfort food to the audiences instead of telling them what they should hear instead of what they want to hear.
That is amazing. That is so true. You know, Charles, one thing also, Donald Trump's a racist. He's a bigot. He's a misogynist. He's a homophobe. Everything. Okay. It seems to me that, you know, he's accused, and I am not a big defender of the president. I like some of his policies, some of them I don't like, and I always call balls and strikes, okay? So let's be clear about that. But, you know, here we have CNN, MSNBC, Washington Post, New York Times, and they bring up the issue of racism. And it seems to me it's the left that is, they are the dog whistle when it comes to these issues. They're always pointing them out. And I find it really remarkable that, you know, OK, Trump said, I am a nationalist. Well, I'm a trained historian. OK, I know what that term means. I know how it can be used. I know how it can be abused. OK. The way Trump said it was perfectly logical, all right? Fine, okay? But the dog whistles come out. I have the impression that people that make these judgment calls have very little knowledge of history, very little knowledge of these civil rights struggles that the United States had to go through and made great achievements, I must say. There are other challenges here, but it seems to me they're very low octane thinkers when it comes to understanding political rhetoric because they interpret it immediately with their own ideological mindset. Go ahead, Charles.
Especially so. I mean, you think about for the last 30, 40 years, mainstream academia, the Harvards, the Yales, et cetera, have been infected by these professors and their supporting cast who I think are ignorant, many of them. So it's not surprising. When you think about the accusation that Donald Trump is a racist, one of the most underreported stories, and I haven't seen recent facts on it, is the degree to which Donald Trump's support among African Americans and minorities has soared since 2016.
Yeah.
You think about across this great country, Democrats are merchants of misery. They want tales of woe so you can then rely on big government. You know, how do the Democrats account for the fact that in inner city after inner city, which they've controlled in many of these blue states, life has been horrible until recently under Donald Trump? African-American minority unemployment is low, and the number of new business startups is high. Confidence is improving. I mean, it's a miracle what he's done, as far as I can tell, in just 2 years. So to call him a racist, when you look at his crowd rallies and he touts those statistics, those crowds are not sitting and, you know, booing when he says African-American unemployment is at its historic low. They're cheering that. So it's a false accusation, in my view.
Roger, you know, I did a program last week, a postmortem of the midterms, and we had a Democratic strategist, and I asked her, you know, what's your takeaway? And she said, well, we got three Hispanic governors, a lesbian senator, and she said their diversity was wonderful. And then I went to the next guest and I said, I thought the country was all about unity, about coming together here. And she had no idea what I was talking about at all. Because I don't care about those attributes. I care about content of character, competence. This is what drives me nuts about the liberal media. Okay, oh, the caravan. Let's talk about the caravan or the invasion. What about we talk about the legality of crossing the U.S. border illegally? This is simple stuff, guys, okay? But you don't get that. No, racist, racist. That's all you get. Roger, go ahead.
Well, you know, I am an actual real live veteran of the civil rights movement. I was heavily in it. And my best friend from grammar school is a fellow named Andy Goodman, was a fellow named Andy Goodman, who was shot by the Klan. So I was there and did that. I can tell you that what's going on by today's Democratic Party is a betrayal of everything we did. They favor a renewed segregation. We were fighting for integration. And there's nothing more despicable to me in my heart than the current Democratic Party's race politics and identity politics. It is the reverse of what was the real intention of Dr. Martin Luther King. And it's appalling, actually. And these idiots in the media that continue it are to be shamed forever. I mean, sorry to be so vehement about
this. Let me jump in here. Let me give Joe the last 25 seconds. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. I think it was brought up before as far as environment and why are so many media organizations liberal? And it's because it's all concentrated in New York and Washington, where I am, in New York, for instance. And when you live in that environment, you suddenly begin to conform to certain ideas and to certain policies and certain perspectives. And I think that's part of the problem, that most of our media, at least nationally, that we see are in areas that probably voted for Hillary Clinton something at a 90-10 rate over Donald Trump. And that's part of the problem as well.
Yep. Almost all the newsrooms on each coast are exactly the same. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in New York and in Nashville, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.